Terry, we now ask our brother Brian to address us on Daniel's vision of the four beasts.
Good morning, my dear brethren and sisters and young people. We have before us this morning a very interesting history lesson. I hope you like history. As I said before, history, when viewed from the point of view of the Word of God, from the controlling force, is indeed a very wonderful story. And so this morning we are looking at some of the great events which have fashioned the world and brought us to the present time, in fact which are determining things which are happening in the world in this very hour. Now, chapter 7, you will note, is in the first year of Belshazzar. So, in fact, we have gone back in time. Because when we were looking at chapter 5, that was the last year of Belshazzar. Belshazzar reigned for 14 years, didn't he? Those 14 years that were concomitant at the same time as the reign of his father, Nabonidus. Am I drowning you immediately? Do you remember that we made reference to that yesterday? Perhaps if I put up some of these names, it might help. There was Nebuchadnezzar, his son, and his son's son. There was a couple of usurpers in between. We had Nebuchadnezzar, we'll just put Neb, and he had a son whose name was Evil-Merodach. Then there was a couple of usurpers, we'll just put one, two for them that had dreadfully long names. And then we came down to Nabonidus, you can have your own pronunciation, and he reigned for 17 years, and his son, whose name was Belshazzar, that's what I like to hear, nice, gentle mutter of wind, he reigned for 14 years, and they were during those 17 years. Everybody remember that now? Nebuchadnezzar, Evil-Merodach, his son, and then Belshazzar, his grandson. So fulfilling those words of Jeremiah 27 and verse 7. So now, when we come to Daniel chapter 7, as you can see, we have come 14 years before chapter 5. And if you just gently turn over to chapter 8, you'll notice that it's 2 years before chapter 8. And it really helps to get all that orientated in your mind, because when you come to chapter 8, it's not like you and I might do it. We might look at chapter 7 one night and chapter 8 the next night. But Daniel had 2 years to think about chapter 7 before he got the further details of chapter 8. There's no doubt about that. He would have screwed his mind around chapter 7 and drained every last bit of information he could have from that before he was given the extra information of chapter 8. Alright, so we can see that the chapters of Daniel are not in chronological order. They are distinctly not. But they are in a meaningful order, according to the terms of the prophecy. It says that Daniel had dreams, visions of his head upon his bed. And he wrote the dream and told the sum of the matters. That's very similar, isn't it, to chapter 2 and verse 28, where Nebuchadnezzar had a dream and visions of his head. Chapter 2 and verse 28. Thy dream, the visions of thy head upon thy bed are these. We can't help notice that, can we? Because, in fact, what Daniel here received in chapter 7 is going to be very much in keeping with the basic information that had so many years before been given to King Nebuchadnezzar. Can you understand how many years that might have been? If this is Belshazzar's first year, right, in the terms of that 70 years, how does it fit in? Pardon? 56 years, approximately, wasn't it? Taking 14 from 70. When was Daniel chapter 2 given? Yes. In terms of those 70 years, was it?
Second year.
Right? So there is 54 years between chapter 2 and chapter 8, or chapter 7. 54 years between those two chapters. So there's no doubt at all that Daniel had plenty of time to think over chapter 2 and to work out what the basic direction of that chapter was. And my dear brothers and sisters, we might also understand, in terms of Daniel's attitude to the situation, as he saw this number of years increase, his age was gathering all the time too, wasn't it? As it was increasing, he may well be thinking to himself of all those prophecies which had to do with the restoration of his people, particularly those chapters in Jeremiah and other passages which had to do with the destruction of Babylon and the restoration of his people. You know, there were many prophecies concerning the destruction of Babylon. I've just made a list of the ones that I can quickly put together. Isaiah 45, Isaiah 47, you know, lots to read up, lots to think about. Jeremiah 50, 51 and 52 that we commented upon yesterday. Jeremiah 25 about the cup. Isaiah 21, Isaiah 13, Isaiah 14. Then there was the uprise of another power, the power of Cyrus that was mentioned in Isaiah 41, Isaiah 44, 45. You know, there were lots of things for Daniel to study as he was growing towards the end of that 70-year period. And it says that he told the sum of the matters. I wonder to whom he told them. I would suggest that his audience must have been somebody like Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego and all those other faithful Jews who were in captivity with him at the same time. And the natural thing would have been that he should relate this prophecy to what had already been told him. Reasonable? Of course it's reasonable. It would have had a tremendous impact upon him and the other Jews who were present in the captivity. So when he came to them and he said, I've had a dream, I've had visions of my head, and I want to tell you what they are. You can imagine a very intelligent, a very interested, a very concerned study class of Jewish people, all in captivity there together, who would have gathered around Daniel and discussed with him the implications of the things which he had seen. Wouldn't that have been exciting? Time was growing ripe, you see, and God was going to give Daniel further details concerning the times in which he lived and the direction things were going. It's not very difficult to understand that if there be four beasts given in this chapter, there would have been some, surely, right from the start, that would have said, well, surely that correlates with, well, what else had they had that was in four stages? Four metals. You wouldn't need to be Einstein to work that out, would you? So that would be the very first thought that surely would come to the mind of that Jewish study class in Babylon, in exile, when Daniel gave them the thoughts of his mind. Not only that, but concerning that fourth kingdom in chapter 2, what I'm doing, my dear brothers and sisters, is giving you the grounds of reason that I believe means emphatically, really, without question, that Daniel 2 and Daniel 7 are to be understood together. They always have been in Christadelphia until the last little few years, and then by so few. But they've always been understood together, and I'm quite sure that that's the only reasonable way to understand it. It just lends itself to that. Daniel chapter 2 and verse 40. And the fourth kingdom shall be strong as iron, forasmuch as iron breaketh in pieces and subdueth all things. And as iron that breaketh all these shall it break in pieces and bruise. So you turn over to Daniel chapter 7 and verse 7. After this I saw in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast. What type of person? What type of kingdom? Dreadful and terrible, and strong exceedingly. Would we imagine it to be the Iron Kingdom? Well, the record goes even further and relates it directly. It had great iron teeth. It devoured and brake in pieces. Is that not almost exactly the very terms that we have in Daniel chapter 2 and verse 40? And as iron that breaketh all these, shall it break in pieces and bruise? It devoured and brake in pieces, and stamped the residue with the feet of it. It was diverse from all of the beasts that were before it. So it really is just plain logic, isn't it, to integrate the two prophecies into one. Notice also, too, again, that the two prophecies speak of four stages. They don't speak of five, they speak of four. And now I have a list of very simple points, I suppose. They're taken from an article by Brother Carter in 1958. And if you're interested in the subject, I really suggest that you read a series of articles by Brother Carter, found in the Christadelphian in 1958. They are absolutely excellent. Absolutely excellent. They're called Daniel and Revelation, I think. They're absolutely excellent. The position he makes and the reasonableness with which he makes that must appeal to any person. And he quotes there from a man called Burks, who lived in the middle of last century. And he's relating Daniel 7 with Daniel 2. He has a lot of points of identification. I love the logic of it. I'll read it to you. Every other argument, without exception, proves the sameness of the empires in the two visions. The number is the same, four in each. The starting point is the same, for each was given while Babylon was the ruling power. The issue, that is what comes out, is the same, for both are immediately followed by the visible kingdom of Christ. No, there's not opportunity to stick a whole lot more somewhere, although some have been missed out, see? Four, and they come to Christ's return, Daniel 2:44. Four, and they come to the dominion given to the saints. So it's a complete story. Start at Babylon at the same point, they go to the same point. Very, very neat. The order is the same. For the kingdoms in the first vision, as all admit, are successive. And in the other, there are no less than seven or eight clauses which denote a succession in time. That is in chapter 7. There's many clauses which indicate that one went on to the other, went on to the other. There is the same gradation for the noblest and the noblest metal, gold, and the noblest animal, the lion, take the lead in each series. Further, the kingdoms in each vision are described as occupying the whole space till the dominion of the saints of God. This is the plain import of the words of verses 17 and 18 of chapter 7. These great beasts, chapter 7, verse 17, these great beasts, which are four kings, which shall arise out of the earth, but the saints of the Most High shall take the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever, even forever and ever. So, I've hammered that home. Perhaps hammered it home. But I've made that plain and spent a little bit of time on that because I don't think that should be any problem to any of us. And I'm very sad that in some places confusion has arisen and that very basic understanding has been taken away. If just that understanding is appreciated, and how simple and reasonable that was, then we would not have disparate views on very important things of prophecy, which unfortunately are lifting their heads today. And could anything be more reasonable than that? You know, the scripture basically tells us itself what those four beasts represent, because as far as the first is concerned, there is no question by anybody that that is Babylon. We are told that thou art this head of God. Daniel chapter 2. As to whom the next might be, well, in chapter 8, the record itself leads us to that conclusion. Because in chapter 8, where we have a battle between a ram and a he-goat, it says in verse 20 that the ram which thou sawest having two horns are the kings of Media and Persia. And nobody would suggest that there was any power in between Babylon and Medo-Persia in terms of time. There wasn't. Everybody knows that. So very clearly, after Babylon came the Medo-Persians. The prophecy itself tells us that. In that sense, there's no need even to recourse of history. Though one, of course, would love to go to history to find out all the other interesting details. But the prophecy itself tells us the next great power that Daniel was to be concerned about was the Medes and Persians, which, of course, were contemporary powers with that of Babylon, just biding in the wings, so to speak, until they should become problems. And then, what shall be the he-goat then of chapter 8 that overtakes from the Medo-Persian ram? Verse 21 tells us, the rough goat is the king of Grecia, and the great horn that is between his eyes is the first king. So it's not as though, really, you have to go to the history books to find out this basic history. The prophecy itself has told us, thou art this head of gold, the king of Medo-Persia, that is the ram, and the goat that overcomes him is the king of Grecia, the great king of Grecia. You know, it just falls into your lap. And of course, no one has ever suggested that Rome did not take over from Greece. Everybody appreciates that that is a sequence. And so I say to you in all reasonableness, and I don't want to appear unreasonably dogmatic, but there just is no other logical conclusion. I say, and I say it very advisedly, if somebody wishes to go a different direction, there's a willfulness in their reasoning. I appeal to you to see that. There is a willfulness in going against the logical outworkings of the understanding of the prophecy. And there was no such willfulness seen in our brotherhood until very recent times. And I think that's advisable. I'd like all of our young people, I'd like them to take two good eyes of that and have a good look at the grounds that we've had a look at this morning. That's a very important understanding. And if therefore you can see that, in all of that plainness, you are right on the way to ascertaining these things correctly. That's why for 100 years there was no divergent view found in the Brotherhood. And unfortunately, it's only outside of the Brotherhood that there has been such a collapse in the basic understanding. For example, if you were to take a Protestant book upon the prophecy of Daniel of, say, the last century, you'd be amazed to find how closely it follows the understanding that we've always had. In fact, everybody felt like that in the Protestant movement, right back for hundreds of years, and only in recent times, that the viewpoint, really, of the Jesuits, those men that I mentioned before, Ribera and Calcaterra, have come in and have upset what is really a very plain understanding of the prophecy. It's not that you can start to fit other great events into this. The prophecy has told you there will be four, beginning in Babylon, going through to the time of the saints. What are those four? Why, everybody knows. Does the prophecy itself tell us of those four? Yes, it does. It tells us that the head of gold is Babylon, the next is going to be the Medo-Persians, the next will be the Greeks, and of course we all know the Romans. Therefore, when we find in the book of Revelation that Daniel chapter 7 is taken straight through and amplified, what's the book of Revelation about? It's got to be about Roman times. It's got to be. So you're not going to understand it, are we? Unless we know something of Roman times. What could be more reasonable than that? So four I mentioned, and four only. And in verse 2, Daniel says, I saw in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of the heaven strove upon the great sea. Winds in Scripture are symbols of armies. For example, in Jeremiah chapter 4, Sometimes you have them spoken of as whirlwinds of the south. Winds that come up and break the status quo. Jeremiah chapter 4 and verse 11. At that time shall it be said to this people and to Jerusalem, a dry wind of the high places in the wilderness toward the daughter of my people, not to fan nor to cleanse. Even a full wind from those places shall come unto me. Now also will I give sentence against them. Behold, he shall come up as clouds, and his chariot shall be as a whirlwind, his horses as swifter than eagles. Woe unto us, for we are spoiled. So there is Babylon, being spoken of as a dry wind of destruction, that would come up with its clouds and chariots as a whirlwind, and it would devour Israel. So when we have therefore four winds of the heaven striving against upon the great sea, we are to understand that that's the forces from all directions, all the winds of change, whipping up and determining what is going to happen upon the great sea. The four winds, just for a couple of other references, are referred to in Revelation chapter 7 and verse 1. Revelation chapter 7 verse 1, a couple of other references too, just while you're making your note, Ezekiel 37 verse 9, Zechariah 2 and verse 6, all mention the four winds. Revelation 7 verse 1 is that one where it says, bind up the four winds. And there was sealing work done while they were calm. See? So it gives you the very idea. Let there be peace for a period of time upon the earth while the work of sealing up God's servants is done. Well, the four winds now are striving upon the great sea. And what we are really seeing here is all the winds of God's effects in all the pressures that have blown and effluxed and through the history of time that have brought forth these great powers in their time as God saw fit. The Great Sea, incidentally, is the original name of the Mediterranean. You know what Mediterranean means? Have you ever stopped to think about it? You know what Terranean means? That means of the land. Mediterranean means between the seas, in the midst of the seas. We use the word all the time, don't we? Sometimes we don't stop and think what it means. So it's Mediterranean means between the lands. And it is, isn't it? That sea, that great sea, that's between the land surfaces. Couldn't really describe any other sea quite like that. It's not a large sea. And there are four great beasts who arise one from the other. Essentially all those powers have been around the Mediterranean Sea. Not, of course, that Persia was immediately alongside the Mediterranean Sea, but it wasn't long before her effects came to the Mediterranean Sea. And she did many battles around that area, and she went right down even to Egypt. So, you know, they're always wrapped around that sea, always involving the nations that were essentially around that sea. The Sea of Nations. So there are many other beasts, verse 4, but there are four great beasts. That's the point that he's making in verse 4. And we're told in verse 17, in very plain language, that those four great beasts, these great beasts which are four kings, which shall arise out of the earth. And they obviously go right through until verse 18, the saints of the Most High shall take the kingdom. Now I don't need to explain that nations are often designated by various beasts or animals, of which you have seen many examples. Perhaps just one quotation that's among many. Proverbs chapter 28. Where it reads in Proverbs 28 and verse 15, as a roaring lion and a raging bear, so is a wicked ruler over the poor people. A little quotation I once read said that earthly power degenerates of itself into brutality. Originally, man was above the beasts. You remember how that in Genesis chapter 1, God gave man dominion over the beast. It's very significant that here in Daniel, the kingdoms of men now are being described or symbolized as beasts. They have accepted the thinking of the serpent from the very beginning when Adam and Eve fell over that consequence. They've accepted the thinking of the serpent and they now are likened here as various beasts of the field. They came up, it says, from the sea through the effects of those winds that God had sent in verse 2, and they were diverse one from another. You know, they were very, very diverse. It's really quite a fascinating story in itself to just contemplate that phrase and extend it out. How different they really were, those four different types of people. Extremely different. You know, when the Romans came, it was a people from a far country whose language thou didst not understand, totally unrelated to all the other powers that had been there at that time. Alright, the first of those in verse 4 is the lion. And that's appropriate because the lion, of course, is the king of beasts. Now, both Babylon and Assyria are likened to lions. Would you turn with me to Jeremiah chapter 4? Two passages in Jeremiah. Jeremiah 4 and verse 7. The lion has come up from his thicket, and the destroyer of the Gentiles is on his way. He has gone forth from his place to make thy land desolate, and thy city shall be laid waste without an inhabitant. Who effected that? Well, from the times of Jeremiah onward, it clearly was Babylon. So Babylon there is being spoken of as a lion coming up against Judah. In the 50th chapter, Jeremiah chapter 50 and verse 17. Israel is a scattered sheep. The lions have driven him away. First, the king of Assyria hath devoured him, and last, this Nebuchadrezzar, king of Babylon, hath broken his bones. So there in 50 verse 17, both Assyria and Babylon are spoken of as lions coming against Judah. It's very interesting that there is a common origin to Assyria and Babylon. Would you turn back with me to Jeremiah, to Genesis, right back to Genesis chapter 10. Those two powers are related in history, in very early history, brought together under the empire of Nimrod, the Nimrodian Empire, as Brother Thomas calls it. In Genesis chapter 10 and verse 10, and the beginning of his, that's Nimrod, so verse 9, the mighty hunter before the Lord, and verse 9, the beginning of his kingdom was Babel, from which, of course, is Babylon, and Erech, and Akkad, and Calneh in the land of Shinar. Out of that land went forth Asher, and builded Nineveh, and the city Rehoboth, and Calah. And as you well know, Nineveh was the capital of the Assyrian power, as Babel was the capital of the Babylonian power. It's interesting that archaeologists in both places, at Nineveh and in Babylon, have excavated many huge images of lions that have been found in those places. This, therefore, this symbol of the lion fits very well that Assyrio-Babylonian power. One merging into the other and still having common origins, which we might earlier describe as the Nimrodian Empire. Now, come back to Daniel chapter 7 and see if that understanding fits in. In Daniel chapter 7 and verse 4, the first was like a lion, but alas, it has different qualities. It's not just a lion. It had eagle's wings. I beheld to the wings thereof were plucked. And then it was elevated, made to stand like a man. The man's heart was given to it. It's a very interesting description in verse 4. A lot more detail than what we had by the statement, "Thou art this head of gold." Now the eagle was an unclean bird. We're told that in Leviticus chapter 11 and verse 13. Known for its swiftness and its strength. And I want you now to look at an interesting reference in Hosea. In Hosea chapter 8, Assyria had been described as an eagle. In Hosea 8 we read, "Set the trumpet to thy mouth, he shall come up as an eagle against the house of Yahweh, because they have transgressed my covenant and trespassed against my law." And in verse 9 it says, "For they are gone up to Assyria, a wild ass alone by himself. Ephraim hath hired lovers." Compare also now, while you're in Hosea, Hosea chapter 5 and verse 14. There we read, "For I will be unto Ephraim as a lion, and as a young lion to the house of Judah. I, even I, will tear and go away. I will take away, and none shall rescue him." That, of course, was effected by the Assyrian, who's mentioned in verse 13. When Ephraim saw his sickness, and Judah saw his wound, then went Ephraim to Assyria, and sent to heal King Jareb. Yet could he not heal you, nor cure you of your wound. Assyria was in the context of thought, and it was by Assyria that God brought that judgment against him in verse 14. So within the prophecy of Hosea, in his 8th chapter and in his 5th chapter, we have Assyria described as both the eagle with wings and the lion that would come and tear. And history records that it was indeed the Assyrian that first marauded through all that area of the Middle Eastern countries and greatly extended his power. Now, if you've got your own map there, that might be even a little more accurate than mine here. But this, in general terms, will help us to appreciate the terms of the prophecy. The area of Babylon, the city of Babylon, is here on the river Euphrates. So that's Euphrates. And here's Tigris. The area of Assyria was here in the north. Now that really needs to go around a bit more because it was a wider area than that, but never mind, that's basically Assyria. And Assyria, in earlier times than the other powers, began to spread in all different directions. I mean, to come down here to Judah was a long way away, wasn't it? And Assyria was the first of those powers that began as a land power and to spread itself in many directions. There was a very strong range of mountains that came through in this area called the Zagros Mountains. It's important actually in history because they divided from the Medes that were on one side and the Assyrians that were on the other. And on the other side of the Zagros Mountains was that high plateau of what we would call today Persia or Iran. So you had the high plateau on one side and Syria up here in this area. And they often marauded down into the south in these very fertile areas that were alongside the two great rivers. And they even came across into this area and down into this area and across here into the hills of the Zagros Mountains, endeavouring on many occasions to overcome the Medes, but were never successful. Assyria's great expansion was actually in the 8th century. That's quite a bit before, isn't it? The time of 606, which we always note as the year of the great ascendancy of Babylon. The 8th century is 100 years and more before that time. In BC 640, Assyria destroyed Elam. Elam is at the head of the Persian Gulf. It was just in that area, an area later which Cyrus was to arise from, which had Susa, later known as Shushan, as its palace. Assyria was always in a state of warfare. They were a very warlike people, and all that is said in Scripture about them is of that way. Twice, for example, the Syrians came right down into Palestine, of which we have one well-known occasion mentioned in the Scriptures. In fact, two times, both those times really, are mentioned in the Scriptures, because they came down in the time of the Northern Kingdom, and they came down in the time of Hezekiah just a little bit later. Well, coming back to Daniel, Daniel chapter 7 and verse 4, he sees a time when the eagle's wings were plucked. Now, the eagle's wings would suggest something that is expanding its influence, stretching its wings. Is that not the most reasonable way to understand that? Well, he sees a time when that marauding, expanding influence is clipped, and there's a change that comes over the kingdom. The marauding nature of the kingdom did change when Babylon conquered Assyria and then brought a new era of relative peace to the world. Babylon was down here, and it was in the time of the great king Nebuchadnezzar that was affected. Dr. Thomas says, the deity punished Assyria for scattering Israel by transferring the dominion over the Nimrudian Empire from Nineveh to Babylon. So whilst they had a common origin, now that marauding power that is historically, that goes down historically as the ravaging power of history, the Assyrians, of whom everyone was scared, that vow was changed. And it says in the terms of the prophecy, it was lifted up and made to stand upon its feet as a man, and a man's heart was given unto it. We ask ourselves, what is the understanding of a man's heart being given unto it? And how was it that this power was overcome? Well, there's a lot of extremely interesting history at that time. I'd like to read to you some of that history and convey as much of it as we can. I can just pick up my thought sequence. The rise of the Medes is one of the important aspects that overturned the Syrians. The Medes, as I said, were in this area here, spreading south. And down here is that little kingdom of Anshan. We extend that a little bit further. That's the area of the Medes. They're both on the Iranian plateau. This is the kingdom of Anshan. That's the kingdom of the Medes. They both came from the east, and they were called Arians. I don't know if people are aware of that, but they were called Arians. And they came from the east, and the larger peoples of the Medes settled in the northern plateau of Persia, and the smaller peoples, later called the Persians, established themselves in Anshan. And for many years the Assyrians had endeavoured to overtake the Medes. But the Medes were a very hardy people, and the Assyrians came to respect them. They made their way up through the various ravines of these hills, endeavouring to take over the Medes, who were great with horse and cavalry. But they were unable to do that. Eventually, the Medes became very powerful, very close to 606 it was. And they combined with the Babylonians, and they overturned the Assyrians. And thus, they divided up the spoils. And so the Medes took the more northern aspect of Syria, and the Babylonians took all the southern area. So Babylon, therefore, was settled in all of this rich and fertile and more consequential territory, while the Medes had the northern area. It says that a man's heart was given unto it. And I believe that is a reference to the coming of Nebuchadnezzar. If you turn back to that Daniel chapter 4, when a man's heart was given to him, Daniel chapter 4, they drove him out, and then his reason returned unto him. Take verse 16 to make the contrast. Let his heart be changed from man's, and let a beast's heart be given unto him. That was a time when he should lose his influence personally, and he should be sent out of the kingdom, and he would eat grass as an ox, and so he would become bestial in disposition. But after that time he would return, and a man's heart would be given unto him. But I want you to notice that it wasn't that he had been bestial before, but that he returned to what he had been before. He says in verse 34, at the end of the days, I, Nebuchadnezzar, lifted up mine eyes unto heaven, and my understanding returned unto me. In other words, he was caused to think as a man again, as he had at earlier times. He had not always been bestial in his disposition. In fact, he had been a very outstanding king in terms of that which had gone before. Because whereas the Assyrians were known as a ravaging and raging, marauding power, that was not so always the designation of the Babylonians. They were described in Habakkuk chapter 1 and verse 6 as a fierce and hasty nation. But through the influence of Daniel upon the king, the kingdom of Babylon took on a disposition which hitherto had not been seen. For where else was a heathen king to receive a vision like Daniel chapter 2? Or where else did a king in history, a heathen king, receive an experience like Daniel chapter 3, when the three friends were found walking in the furnace? Or where also did a king put forth a proclamation, as in Daniel chapter 4, that all peoples, nations and languages should serve the King of Heaven? They clearly are unprecedented events. There was nothing like that in the world of the Gentiles before that time, perhaps not since. And so we can understand in the terms of Daniel chapter 7 that a different experience, a king of larger mind, a king who was more associated with divine things than any heathen king had been, perhaps until Pharaoh before, who was in the company of Joseph, there was a different approach given to him. I mean, look how Daniel was able to speak to Nebuchadnezzar. Break off thy sins by righteousness, and thine iniquities by showing mercy to the poor. It may be a lengthening of thy tranquility. You know, that clearly recognizes that Nebuchadnezzar had ascended in his mind to a higher stand than had been seen before. And I think those influences are the clear understanding of what we have in Daniel chapter 7 verse 4, that a man's heart was given unto him. That is a unique experience in history. No, he even appointed Daniel, didn't he, into high office. He appointed his three friends, Jewish people, men of God, he appointed into high office. Don't you imagine that their influence throughout that kingdom, in such important positions of influence, would have been very consequential? The administration of, therefore, of that kingdom would have been different than it may have been ever in the past. So we have a very unique reference in verse 4 to a humanity, a humane disposition being exercised by that kingdom. And I believe that that's probably why it's described as the more noble metal of gold. One of the reasons. In that sense, it was more noble than those that were to come thereafter. Now in verse 5 we have another beast, a second, like to a bear. And it raised up itself on one side, which means therefore that it had two sides. That's the implication of it. It raised itself up on one side. And it had three ribs in the mouth of it, between the teeth of it. And they said thus unto it, arise, devour much flesh. Now a lot of our time this morning, whatsoever is left, which is very little, is going to be to look at the circumstances of the rise of the Medo-Persian power. Send me notes here, I'm not sure where we are. Just a little bit of chronology first. The rise of Cyrus the Great was a very significant time in history, and he was one of what we call the Achaemenid kings, and this is how he arrived. There was a man called Cyrus the First, nothing to do with what we've gone before, and he had a son called Cambyses. This Cyrus the First was the king of Anshan, that little kingdom that I mentioned to you just north of the top of the Persian Gulf. He gave rise to a boy which we know as Cyrus the Great. He was really Cyrus the Second. We'll put it on the side here, Cyrus the Great. All right. That's the one of the prophets, Cyrus the Great. Now the interesting thing about Cyrus the Great is that he married a woman who was from the other kingdom of the Arians, that is, from the Medes. And it happened this way. Cambyses married a woman called Mandane. Not Mandane, Mandane. And from that issued forth, or Mandane, just to put her in her line, was from Astyages. You can remember that easy, aren't you? Who was from a great king of the Medes called Darius. Probably Darius the First. And that's very important. We speak of the kingdom of the Medes and the Persians. And it's that basic fact that caused Persians. Because this is the Median line, and that is the Persian line. How did Cyrus, who was down in the small kingdom of Anshan, take over the great power of the Medes? Well, it happened this way. Astyages was a rather weak character. He was in the kingdom of the Medes here. So we've got Astyages. He was a man who was given to fits and starts. And he had a dream concerning his daughter that she hated him. She didn't hate him at all. But he had a dream that she hated him. So instead of marrying her off to one of his princes, the princes of the Medes, he decided that he'd marry her off to one of the princes of Anshan, and so she came to marry Cyrus, who later was Cyrus the Great. Another one of his bits was that this Cyrus the Great should be killed. It was, in fact, his grandson, wasn't it? Because here is Astyages, here is his daughter, here is the son that came from that union. So Astyages was the grandfather of Cyrus the Great. And he had some other dream which indicated to him that he ought to dispose of Cyrus the Great. It was a complete fit. There was no basis to it. So he sent down one of his generals that he should dispose of Cyrus the Great, who was at that time just a little boy. However, the general couldn't do it. He couldn't bring himself to such a bloodthirsty event, and so he took Cyrus the Great and he cared for him in time. The boy grew up and he had a most remarkable character. He was one of those brilliant natural leaders of history. Men just gathered to his side. They were attracted by the fairness of his approach, by his appeal to righteousness and decency and reasonableness. So Cyrus the Great became a very natural leader. And so, seeing that, Astyages intended that he would go against Cyrus, who was making this little kingdom down here now, this little kingdom of Anshan, that had been nothing in the past, was beginning to make it as something that was known. And so the Medes, who were set on further conquest over here, felt that they should dominate this area first, and subjugate this small uprising from their grandson, Cyrus, who was down here in Anshan. However, when they travelled the 400 miles down to the battle, the soldiers of Astyages, the grandfather of the Medes, they in fact deserted him, and they went over to Cyrus. There was not a shot fired. Well, there couldn't have been a shot fired in those days, but there was not an arrow slung. So, almost as a gift, the Medes handed the kingdom over to Cyrus the Great. It was one of the great events of history, because this man was nothing until that time. Suddenly, he has erupted upon the earth. Now, Cyrus substantiated his dominion over all the Iranian plateau, as we would call it today. And he subjugated and settled it all through this northern area until it was all firmly under his control. But still in the real world of the West, he was really an unheard of voice. Then he made his approach. He started to come westward. Now there wasn't this area here a very great kingdom called the Kingdom of the Lydians. The world at that time had been spread between the Medes, who were in this area here, the Babylonians. Remember that the Medes had also divided up the spoils of Babylon. So they, in this area here, there was Babylon in here, Babylonia, and then there was the Lydians. So there was those three great powers. So when now Cyrus has taken over the Medes, he is occupying a fairly extensive territory that's far, far removed from the tiny little area that he had down in Anshan before. And so now he began to trot towards the west. And there was in Lydia at that time a man called Croesus. Have you heard of Croesus? Yes, the gold king, so to speak. He had gold mines in his kingdom, and he owned them personally. You know, somebody in South Africa had owned the gold mines personally. That's what I almost do. They would be very, very rich. Well, Croesus was by far the most wealthy man in the world at that time. And so he had a very powerful army here, right alongside the Aegean Sea, that's the Greek Sea in there, and he dominated this area. There was a river there called the River Halys. The River Halys, important river historically, and the Lydians and the Medes had drawn up that as the frontier. None crossed over that river, and they agreed that that would be the boundary between them. Well, when now Cyrus was gathering in force and beginning to clean up all this area of the Medes and bring it under his control, Croesus realized that he had a problem. And this is a very fascinating story. A very fascinating story in which, in fact, Isaiah the prophet had played a role. He began then to consult all the kingdoms that were around him. He made, in fact, first a provocative move. He moved over the River Halys with a group of soldiers, and he took a city on the other side. It was a provocative and doomsdaying experience, because Cyrus, of course, got to know, and he drew his forces up to the River Halys. He was not going to be provoked like that. This man that had suddenly come from nowhere. Croesus just wondered wherever he was. What was going to stop this bird from the east that was just spreading its wings across all nations and just mopping them up one after the other, come from nowhere? So he went to all of the gods of the world at that time. And there were various places which they called oracles. And they used to go and consult these oracles to find out things of the future. And they were found in Egypt, they were found in Babylon, they were found all through the world at different places. And he said to them, if you can tell me what I am doing 100 days from after I send out my messengers, then the oracle that can tell me that is the one that I will consult, and I will give great rewards to as to what I should do in the matter of science. So back comes a message from all these different people as to what he would be doing in 100 days from when he sent his messengers out to them all. And the oracle in Delphi, which is here in Greece, sent back the message that you will be boiling a lamb with a tortoise in a brazen receptacle at that time. Well, quite a crazy thing to say. But it was right. Which obviously means those in Delphi had some kind of secret understanding of what was happening. I mean, it took days to get messages, didn't it? Somehow or other, they sent back this message, and it was right. He was boiling a lamb with a tortoise. Have you ever heard of such a thing? In a brazen vessel. And so he was so excited by that that he sent to every citizen of Delphi all kinds of rewards. And then he said, well, what do I do now in respect to Cyrus? He consulted all the gods of the world, you see. And they said to him, in the day that the king Croesus attacks the Persians, they will destroy a great empire. Oh, said Croesus, that's delightful information. I'm therefore ready for the battle, and he prepared to go across the river Halys. But you know, you can read that message both ways, can't you? It may not necessarily mean that you're going to be the destroyer. It might be that your great kingdom will be destroyed. So, you know, the Delphians were not silly, were they? They had a bet both ways. Because there were two great powers, and one of them was going to lose. One of them was going to be destroyed. And of course, in fact, it was the Cretans, it was the Lydians that were destroyed. They retired back into the city of Sardis. And believing Sardis to be an impregnable fortress, which if you've read about Sardis, you remember that it is a most remarkable city in its natural fortifications. However, one soldier among the Sardians dropped his helmet. And as the night was coming on, he sneaked over the wall in a way to get his helmet. The Persians being around the city, but of course not immediately underneath it. And it just so happened that one of the soldiers of the Persian army saw this man getting up back through the wall of the city and realized that there was a means of climbing that wall if only you knew it, because he just saw the technique of this individual soldier. And so the next day, they, having seen that, perfected the art, and they invaded Sardis and they took it. Croesus himself being burnt by placing his own throne on a whole heap of wood, and up he went with his throne. So, Cyrus now was king over all the area except for Babylon. Babylon, therefore, looked to him as the great prize. You see, this little wall here that I've built, that I've indicated here, is called the Median Wall. These were two great rivers, and therefore the kingdom of Babylon's being here on the river Euphrates meant that any northern power had to cross two great rivers. And that was a very difficult thing to do. And there were other branches of those rivers that made it even more difficult again. And then if you should think that you should come through this way towards Babylon, and then there was the Median Wall that might stop you, which was a series of fortifications and a wall adjoining the two. So Babylon felt very, very secure down here upon the waters, irrigating all of the territory around, irrigating within her city. How could she ever be taken? Well, Cyrus came down through this part and he breached the Median Wall. It was never built for him. Who was he? Unknown in history. Now suddenly he's banishing all nations before him. And he came down to the city of Babylon, and of course you know the story. The story is that he actually diverted the rivers of the Euphrates. A technique which he had perfected in an earlier campaign when he diverted another one of the branches of the River Tigris on his advancement towards Babylon. And you know, what an achievement that was. It wasn't though you rang up the earth-moving company and asked for 50,000 bulldozers. They all had to do it by pick and shovel. Hundreds of thousands of soldiers working by pick and shovel diverted the waters of the river, that eventually the tide might drop. They didn't divert it entirely, but they were able therefore to drop the course of the river and to send some of the waters in another way so that the level of the river dropped. And that river that went through the great city of Babylon therefore allowed around its edges. It allowed soldiers to go. And of course inside, as we learnt yesterday, Belshazzar was having a glorious time in his feast, totally unconcerned about any invading power. But God had decreed that Cyrus would receive those kingdoms. Now, just by way of conclusion, I want us, perhaps unexpectedly, to turn to the prophet Isaiah, who had seen these things so long before. In Isaiah chapter 41, in verse 1, I think these are absolutely exciting chapters. Keep silence before me, O islands.
and let the people renew their strength. Let them come near, let them speak, let us come near together to judgment. Who raised up the righteous man from the east, calling him to his foot, gave the nations before him, and made him rule over kings? He gave them as the dust to his sword, and as the driven stubble to his bow. He just gobbled up and swept over the nations, one after the other, and God says, who gave that to him? Who arranged that this man from the east, you see, this was much towards the east than any other that power had been before. Who gave these things to the man of the east? And describes him as the righteous man, because that's how he was known and understood, not only among the Persians, but among other empires as well. When he conquered, he did so with great generosity of heart. He did not crush, but rather he built up. He brought them into his economy. He established them with good administration. He said, I wish to cooperate with you, not to crush you. And so a different era had come over the earth. He pursued them and passed safely, even by the way that he had gone with his feet. Who hath wrought and done it, calling the generations from the beginning? I, Yahweh, the first and the last. I am he. And then we have a most intriguing section. Don't know if you've ever had any ideas about what this is about, but this is the answer, and it's most interesting. When that was to happen, when Cyrus was suddenly to erupt in the earth, it says in verse 5, the isles saw it and feared. That is, the countries of the Gentiles. They saw it and feared. They were in consternation about the sudden uprise of this great power. The ends of the earth were afraid, drew near and came. In what way did they draw near and come? They helped everyone his neighbour. And everyone said to his brother, be of good courage. We shall overcome this power. How shall we overcome? By idolatry. By the cooperation of our gods. So the carpenter encouraged the goldsmith, and he that smootheth with the hammer, him that smote the anvil, saying, it is ready for the soldering. And he fastened it with nails, that it should not be moved. What did they look to? In the hour when Cyrus was sweeping the earth, they looked to their gods. And that's exactly what happened. In the example that I mentioned to you of Croesus, the king of the Lydians, he looked to all the world for encouragement, and he received it from all the various oracles of the heathen gods at that time, just like Isaiah had said at that very time. Isn't that wonderful, my dear brothers and sisters? Isn't that remarkable? Found in the prophecy of Isaiah before these times, some 150 years. What an amazing prophecy that is. How interesting. You know, there's a lot about Cyrus in the prophecy of Isaiah. Is he also verse 25? I have raised up one from the north, and he shall come from the rising of the sun, from the east. Shall he call upon my name? And he shall come upon princes as upon mortar, and as the potter treadeth clay. Very, very fascinating. Again, in the 54th chapter. Here it actually mentions him by name. Verse 24. Thus saith Yahweh thy Redeemer, he that formed thee from the womb, I am Yahweh that maketh all things, that stretcheth forth the heavens alone, that spreadeth abroad the earth by myself, that frustrateth the tokens of the liars, and maketh diviners mad, that turneth wise men backward, and maketh their knowledge foolish. 44:25, I'm sorry. 44:25. Not only, dear brethren and sisters, was that the case of Croesus and the Lydians, but as I mentioned, do you remember, I think it was yesterday, that when Cyrus came against the city of Babylon, do you remember that Nabonidus had gathered together all the various idols of the nations, Nabonidus with Belshazzar, and when that city was taken, Babylon, it was packed jam full with all the gods of the nations. They were all gathered into Babylon, which in fact they got their origin. So it was very appropriate that at the time of their capture, they should be all there sitting in there together. How did the world then cooperate together against this man that God had suddenly caused to come upon the scene? By gathering together with their idols. By the carpenter cooperating with the goldsmith and so forth. They got together with their idols All their tokens of the liars are frustrated, says God in verse 25. The diviners are made mad that turn to wise men backward and maketh their knowledge foolish. Isn't that interesting? Oh, that's interesting, my dear brothers and sisters. What a glorious understanding we have in this word of truth. It's a most remarkable book. Look how it goes on to say, to speak. Are we in the context of the things we're looking at? That confirmeth the word of his servant and performeth the counsel of his messengers. That saith to Jerusalem, thou shalt be inhabited. And to the cities of Judah, ye shall be built. And I will raise up the decayed places thereof. Who gave that decree that Israel should return after BC 536 when Babylon was eclipsed? It was by King Cyrus, wasn't it? The great King Cyrus, as recorded here in Isaiah, and also recorded in the second of Chronicles, chapter 36, as in Ezra chapter 1 and verse 1. Yahweh stirred up the spirit of Cyrus, that he made proclamation that the people should go back. What year was that? It was in Cyrus's first year. So it was very intimately involved with the whole work that Cyrus would do. Not only would he downturn Babylon, but he also would give glorious decree of liberation to the children of Judah. Are we talking about Cyrus? Look at verse 27. That saith to the deep, be dry, and I will dry up thy rivers. And that's the very means by which he overturned the great kingdom of Babylon. So they were able to go up along the riverbanks, up to the gates of Babylon that faced that river, all along the concourse of the river. As it went through the city of Babylon, there were various stages of access to the river, because of course tremendous trade was done up and down that river. So they had gates that were opened or closed to allow the trafficking to go on along that river. It was connected to the world at that time. You went down the river of Euphrates, you went up the river Tigris, you went to all the various branches of those rivers. It was all on the same trade route if you were on the river, or then you went out to the Persian Gulf and to the countries beyond. So you had to be on the river to be on the trade route. So Babylon was situated there beautifully on the river, and so she opened her gates and at night she closed them. And there was a very strict routine, so that there was really no way of coming into that city. In every sense it was guarded. It just so happened, when Belshazzar was having his wine from that temple vessel, it just so happened that on that night somebody had unfortunately left one of the gates open, and streaming through went the forces of Cyrus. So, that saith to the deep, be dry, and I will dry up thy rivers. And there is his very name in verse 28. That saith of Cyrus, he is my shepherd. What an amazing statement. And shall perform all my pleasure. Even saying to Jerusalem, thou shalt be built. And to the temple, thy foundation shall be laid. He paid for that. And saw that his governor prospered the work on the other side of the river, down there in Judah. Thus saith Yahweh, verse 45, and these words are 150 years before they were accomplished in BC 536. Thus saith Yahweh to his anointed, to Cyrus, whose right hand I have holden, to subdue nations before him, and I will loose the loins of kings, to open before him the two-leaved gates, and the gates shall not be shut, as they weren't on that night of his invasion. Strangely the gates were open, and in he went. I will go before thee and make the crooked places straight. I will break in pieces the gates of brass, and cut in sunder the bars of iron. The median wall just collapsed before him. I will give thee the treasures of darkness, in which of course were those golden vessels from the temple of Yahweh. I will give thee the treasures of darkness, and hidden riches of secret places, that thou mayest know that I, Yahweh, which call thee by thy name, and the God of Israel. And you know, my dear brothers and sisters, as a final thought, I believe that when he came into that city and he looked for whom was the governor of that city, who did he find? He found an old Jew of 84 years. There he was with a golden chain around his neck, only recently appointed as the third in the kingdom. Belshazzar has gone. Nabonidus is in hiding. Who shall he negotiate with but this old foreigner, this Jewish man, father of the children in exile, beloved of the children of Judah? And I believe that Daniel sat down with him
when Cyrus, as a wise man, wanted to know about him, that Daniel sat down with him and he brought out that prophecy of Isaiah, and he said, "Great thou art, Cyrus, it is the God of heaven that has given you these kingdoms. See here your name. See here your name." And he would have explained to him, as you and I have, and with all the excitement that you and I feel about in reading those things, Daniel the great prophet would have explained to the great King Cyrus that in fact it was not by his own might, not by power or might, but by the Spirit of God that this great city had been given into his hands, and that his duty then was to give liberty to the people of the God of Israel, so that in the first year of Cyrus, the very year when he took Babylon, he gave decree that those captives should come back. So we see the beautiful hand of prophecy. Surely it is an expression of the loving kindness of God.